Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It's Wednesday, October 3rd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. There's no better time to get involved with ending marijuana prohibition in America than right now. All you have to do is visit normal.org, that's N-O-R-M-L.org, to make your donation or join Normal today. Folks, there has been a wonderful plethora of activity with online activism and folks getting involved with Normal through different sites such as MySpace and Facebook. There are over 30,000 friends to the official National Normal profile on MySpace. If you'd like to become a MySpace friend, you can link up right up at normalaudiostash.com. We've got an official National Normal MySpace link up there. Also up on the Facebook networking website, they have something called Causes. And the Normal Cause has almost 250,000 Facebook members right now. If you'd like to link up to the cause up on Facebook and you're already a Facebook member, just search Normal in Causes up there and join about 250,000 of us in supporting Normal, ending prohibition, and legalizing marijuana here in the United States. We're going to talk more about that Facebook activity here on the program next week. Here in the Audio Stash today, the best free daily stash anywhere in the world. We've got a couple of great interviews for you. Our regular Wednesday Cannabis Science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine airs today. We have a new interview with Mitch every single Wednesday. You can also catch a monthly column for Mitch in High Times Magazine. That's coming up first today. Also, a Forbes Magazine article out this month details the economics of marijuana. How much money we're missing out on, and it is hundreds of billions of dollars, and how much we spend on enforcement right now. That article is based on data from John Gatman, a former director of Normal, who continues to compile data and publish reports detailing the economics of marijuana in the United States. We got a chance to interview John here on the Audio Stash. We're going to revisit that interview here today. Tomorrow in the program, we're going to highlight a little bit more of that conference audio from 2006. Again, the 2007 conference starts up next Friday. You can link up and still get tickets and conference registrations for the Los Angeles conference right up at normalaudiostash.com. And of course, the Audio Stash will be there. We'll have special podcasts right from the Normal conference. And in Friday's Stash this week, we'll have Bill Maher's 2005 Normal conference keynote address. Very cool stuff from Mr. Maher, who frequently features marijuana in his television programs and live performances. Bill Maher, of course, on the Normal Advisory Board with the likes of Ann Dryan, Tommy Chong, and Willie Nelson, and many others. Make sure you join all the celebrities on the advisory board and all of us, making sure that marijuana is legalized in the United States. Again, all you have to do to join or make a donation is visit norml.org. Let's open up our stash today with our cannabis science segment. Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to speak with Dr. Mitch Earlywine about the science of cannabis. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com, and you can check out a monthly column from Mitch in High Times Magazine. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Oh, great to be on, Chris.
Very good to speak with you again this week, Mitch. We're going to discuss a story in the Normal press release last week. It's entitled, Criminal Penalties, Youth Drug Prevention Programs Have Little Influence on Drug-Making Decisions. So, all these school programs like DARE seem to be playing little into people's decisions to actually experiment with or use illicit substances, including marijuana. Mitch, is that a surprise?
It's curious because at least all our follow-up data from the old DARE, the DARE that, you know, was popular in 1999 through 2001, suggests that it just doesn't do the trick. And this idea of bringing police into the school and having them talk to kids and getting them to, you know, make these agreements about not using drugs, in the long-term follow-up, all the data really suggests is that they have better attitudes about police. I'm eager to get some of the new data on this DARE Plus program, which would be, you know, interesting, but I'm not optimistic, and I would much prefer, you know, parents and families take the reins on the drug prevention problems and kind of do that themselves. And that is, in fact, consistent with the results of this new study, which suggests that, you know, having the DARE program really played a very small or, you know, zero role in the decisions that these people made when they were thinking about using marijuana and other drugs.
And something the report notes is that many people try marijuana out of a general curiosity about its effects, not even necessarily to experience a full-blown high. So can some of this be attributed to natural human curiosity overall?
In fact, when you look at the folks who initiate and the folks who don't, it's generally a curiosity and sensation-seeking personality trait that distinguishes between them. So these are the people who also like to try new foods, who want to go visit exotic lands, who will, you know, stand in line to ride the front car of the roller coaster. And so it wouldn't be a big surprise that they would also be willing to try something new in this domain. What I like about this study, too, is that it really goes in depth with the individual interviews in an area, this was done in Oklahoma, where, you know, the laws are really harsh on marijuana, and yet you see very little mention of anyone saying, oh, I was offered it and thought, oh, no, I don't want to get in trouble with the law. I'll never do it. It just doesn't have the impact that you would think it would have, given all the effort we seem to put into the harsh penalties for possession.
Also, Mitch, a few years back, the Annenberg Center for Public Policy looked at the National Youth Anti-Drug Media Campaign and found that the ads running in the late 90s and early millennium actually were making kids want to try pot more after they viewed the anti-pot ads. So one has to wonder that when police and others come into schools and say, drugs are bad, okay, don't do them, if that doesn't have the opposite effect.
What we found is this program isn't really played out the way it was originally planned. So the first notion behind these was to bring some hip, older teenager into the class and have him or her talk about health consequences and making decisions and getting in touch with your values. And unfortunately, it kind of took on a life of its own when law enforcement got involved. I think that this is probably a fun program for people in law enforcement, and they definitely want to feel like they're having an impact in this domain. But now that the data suggests it's just not working, it's certainly time to move on. And we do have at least one study that suggests that the information alone, so just going in and explaining, hey, here are all these different drugs, doesn't seem to help at all. And in at least in students who are higher in socioeconomic status, folks who would probably have more spending money, it can actually lead to an increased likelihood of trying drugs rather than a decreased likelihood, which is clearly counter to what the plan was.
That's a very interesting point you just brought up there, Mitch, about kids with more spending money might having more opportunity to try illicit substances because they can afford them. But many of these anti-drug programs focus on lower-income communities. Is that kind of a misnomer then?
It's curious because the things that are the high risk for kids at least getting into problematic drug use include having spending money, mentioning a lot of stress and anxiety, and then boredom. And you can imagine how certainly boredom, stress, and anxiety would be particularly big issues in folks who are living in the inner city. They don't have a lot of parks that they can run to play to. You know, the boys' clubs aren't what they used to be. Some of these programs that were really helpful for keeping folks occupied and teaching them good leisure skills have really taken a dive in the last decade, and so that would certainly be an issue. But that spending money is also a big predictor, and obviously, you know, trying to teach people who have money good ways to spend it has been a challenge for the whole United States across all age groups, and obviously not a big issue among the inner city kids who just don't seem to have much spending money at all.
When it comes to a different approach, perhaps one that will have a full impact on teenage illicit substance use, what has been successful out there?
The stuff that I mentioned some in my book, The Parent's Guide to Marijuana, focuses on some data gathered by my friend Steve Sussman at University of Southern California. And what he's finding is it's much more about getting people in touch with their own values and the things that they want to do in life rather than saying, oh, drugs are evil. So if you sit down and talk about, gee, where do you want to be in a year? Where do you want to be in 5 years? And often you get some pretty interesting, pretty compelling dreams that all these folks have, and then you say, okay, well, what do you need to do in order to make that happen? And, you know, they're not going to spontaneously say, oh, never do drugs, but they're going to walk through what they want to study, where they want to work, how they want to exercise, how they want to keep in shape, you know, depending on what the goals are. And then you often see them, rather than saying no to drugs, they're saying yes to all these alternative behaviors that are generally inconsistent with, you know, the negative health consequences of early drug use, and then they get attached to that rather than just running away from something that they've been told to run away from.
Mitch, we also have this sort of age goal of 21 for alcohol. Does that help deter teen use? I mean, saying to kids that you don't have to abstain forever, but you do have to wait until this age, until your body is physically ready. Does that work?
The data are kind of mixed on that. There have definitely been a lot of improvements on teen intoxicated driving since we altered the drinking age up to 21 across all the United States. But when we look at some of the countries that are less uptight about this, if you will, and talk about some of the data that like people like Stanton Peel often refer to, where parents and children do have a drink, often as part of a religious ritual or wine at dinner kind of situation, these folks, if they really are getting it modeled well, seem to do okay. And I feel like also that idea that you're alluding to, that it's not forever. It's we want to make sure things are set on a good course before you start experimenting with this. That seems to go well. And I think teens in particular are accustomed to the idea that, okay, there's an age when we think it's okay you should drive. There's an age for when you should drink. When you're a little bitty kid, you don't want to use a chainsaw either. It's like there are all these things that sort of make sense. And if we can walk them through why marijuana is also part of that and why we think it makes sense that they should wait, I think that that'll go a long way. Whereas these blanket, oh, just don't ever do it statements, we need a stronger rationale if we want to make that argument. And unfortunately, the data suggests that for marijuana, if you are somebody who starts using late in life, you can use for years and years without any negative consequences. And I think teens have a good sense of that in a way, and so that's why that argument's just not going to work.
And recently we've also seen a lot of criticism leveled at the sexual abstinence programs for teens. Does the approach of saying to someone, no, don't ever do this, does that ever work?
In fact, in some studies in social psychology, it really backfires. So if you have a forbidden toy with little kids and say, okay, you can play with anything you want, but you can't play with this thing, of course, that's the thing they want to play with the most. And so I feel like in some ways, laying this on more of a continuum instead of this, it's black or it's white, it's evil or it's fine, will give us an opportunity to let folks see it in less of a forbidden fruit kind of way and have a better impact in the long run.
And when groups like Normal and others prevail in this fight to legalize marijuana, and we do have a legally regulated market in the United States, what do you think would be an acceptable age for people to purchase and use marijuana, do you think?
I know that the big move has been to say 21 because we've got a good model for that with alcohol, and I certainly like that idea. The empirical support for that age is not particularly strong, and as some of my younger students are constantly pointing out to, 18 is actually an age where, at least based on the brain development data and some of the IQ data, 18 would probably be a reasonable age to argue for as well. But as you can imagine, saying that kind of thing is what gets me nailed to the cross on the cover of People magazine. So we'll have to wait and see.
Well, hopefully we'll never have to see you crucified in a national magazine out there, Mitch. But yeah, there's still about 25% of teens who do try pot in high school. If we did have a regulated market and the age was set at 18, could we perhaps decrease that amount of teenage users?
It requires so much speculation on my part that I honestly don't have any data I can point to say this is okay. We have seen with other, forbidden things or things that are regulated by age, that people tend to respect it, but there's always going to be a small proportion of folks who don't wait until that very end. If we turn to the Netherlands and other countries with more relaxed cannabis policies, we often see one of these strange celebratory rites of passage. So you reach the age when it's suddenly legal and you have one big binge initial trying outing, if you will, and then, in fact, relatively problem-free use for the subsequent years. So it wouldn't particularly freak me out if suddenly somebody on their 18th birthday got to go out with all their friends and celebrate with a legal cannabis market, and it would certainly be markedly better than some of the rituals I see around people turning 21 and going out and drinking to the point of, literally danger. And so, yeah, I think that there's a lot of promise in that, and of course that's why we do this work.
Now, this study we're discussing does come from Oklahoma, where some of the harshest marijuana penalties exist, as pointed out by Paul Armentano in the article. Does this correlate to the fact that most don't even consider those criminal penalties, even if they are extremely harsh, as they are in Oklahoma? They don't even consider those criminal penalties when they decide to try pot.
When you look at the penalties and things along those lines, the severity of penalty doesn't often predict use. It's the probability of actually getting caught. And in truth, if you're, white and male and not dealing, your chances of getting busted for possession, even if you have cannabis with you all the time, are probably less than 3%. And obviously, that's just not enough to make people take the law into account when they're making these decisions.
Righto, Mitch. Well, this has been a great conversation here today. I really do appreciate you joining us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash. He's professor of psychology at the State University of New York, author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. Mitch will be at the 2007 Annual Normal Conference on a number of panels out there. Of course, Normal's daily Audio Stash will be there, so you'll hear Mitch live at the Normal Conference. Stay tuned. Coming up next is our interview with policy expert John Getman about the economics of marijuana in America. John is really recognized as the expert on this case, and he was cited in recent articles in Forbes magazine. That's coming up next. This month in Forbes magazine, there's an article entitled Marijuana, the $42 billion question, that explores the finances of marijuana in America as it stands right now, largely through the data and the work of John Getman, who used to be a director at Normal. John has published extensively on the topic of the marijuana economy in the United States, how much we're losing out on by not having a regulated market, and how much we're spending right now on enforcement. Well, I got a chance to interview John about his most recent set of data right here on the Audio Stash. We're going to revisit that interview right now. We have links to more information about John Getman's data right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. John, this report highlighting marijuana as the biggest U.S. cash crop is getting a lot of attention around the world. First, tell us how you came to this conclusion and what data you used to get there.
Well, it's actually based on U.S. government reports that estimate that American marijuana farmers produce 22 million pounds of marijuana annually. That's 10,000 metric tons. And that estimate has been circulating in government reports now for a couple of years. And what's significant about it is that in 1981, they estimated that we only produced 1,000 metric tons, that is 2.2 million pounds. And now, after 25 years of an incredible eradication program that's been very ambitious, that has pulled out of the ground over 103 million cultivated plants over 25 years, after all this effort, the market has grown tenfold. So it's not, it's a remarkable accomplishment for American marijuana farmers, and it's quite an indictment about the federal program.
John, this report goes state by state, so who's producing the most and who is producing the least marijuana out there?
The states with the most marijuana production are, the top 10 are California, Tennessee, Kentucky, Hawaii, Washington, North Carolina, Florida, Alabama, West Virginia, and Oregon. The least producing states are actually some of the smaller states and some of the more northern states where there's less activity, and I actually don't have a list handy of those states. But basically, marijuana has spread from California and Hawaii in 1979 to just about every state in the country right now.
You also make a distinction between indoor and outdoor marijuana cultivation. Why is that distinction important?
Well, for one thing, it indicates the just how much marijuana cultivation has spread throughout the country, even to the point where there's a sizable quantity grown indoors. Also, the Drug Enforcement Administration, when they report on how many plants they seize every year, they provide information on the indoor cultivation seizures as well. And that's really quite a growing area, actually no pun intended, of the marijuana crop. And the continuing increase in the size of and the extent of indoor marijuana cultivation, it just underscores how impossible it is to get this market under control using law enforcement techniques. I mean, the fact is, they can fly around the country all they want and try to get, you know, better and better and more eagle-eyed personnel to spot marijuana plants outside, but there's not as much they can do to find this marijuana that's being grown inside. In fact, the top 10 indoor producing states are California, Washington, Florida, Oregon, Texas, Alaska, Indiana, Michigan, Kentucky, and Ohio. I tell you, it's really interesting to see Florida on that list, because you'd think that Florida, being, you know, one of our southernmost states, would have a large outdoor crop, and it certainly has a significant outdoor crop, but even with the great weather they have outside, there's this incredible amount of marijuana cultivation indoors.
It used to be we had all kinds of harvest festivals around the country in the fall, but not so much anymore because marijuana is being harvested year-round now.
Absolutely. In fact, even outdoors in Hawaii, they have three crops a year. But the indoor phenomena is also a great reflection of the ongoing demand for marijuana. And in fact, one of the questions I've been asked frequently in many interviews about this report is, you know, what's responsible for this growth in marijuana cultivation in the U.S.? And the answer is simple
economics may not be as simple for me to say, but simple economics, supply and demand. And we've gone from bringing in most of our marijuana from other countries to growing it as much as we can, growing it here in the U.S.
Something else you talk about in the report, John, when you discuss California, is that the state produces more marijuana there than the pot smokers can consume. That's taken the number of 3.3 million cannabis consumers in California. John, how do we know that number? How do we count how many pot smokers are in America?
Well, the federal government goes around asking people, and surprisingly, people tend to tell the truth in many surveys. There's an annual survey done in the United States called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and it's been asking people about drug use and related issues now for a good 20, 25 years. They used to do it every 3 or 4 years, and then they started doing it every year as drug policy got to be a more important policy issue in this country. And, you know, there's little things one can quibble about this survey, and certainly one has to note that there would be people who are reluctant to talk about illegal activity and report it to the government. But nonetheless, it's a confidential survey, and it's really the only numbers we have, and it's the best numbers we have on marijuana and other drug use in the country. And it indicates that there's 25 million people who use marijuana annually. Oh, and by the way, they improved the survey instrument, that is the techniques, the policies, the questionnaire they give people. They improved this in 2002 and discovered another 5 million annual marijuana smokers they didn't know about the year before, mainly because people weren't completing the entire survey, and they started paying people to complete the whole survey. It's a big, big survey. And they got better data. So they get this information from there, and one of the reasons that we suspect that California exports a lot of marijuana is that we take the, you know, California has, I think, 13% of the annual marijuana uses in the country, but it's responsible for some 38% of all the marijuana production in the country. So just using that disparity in those two figures, there's 9 states that appear to be growing marijuana and exporting it to other states, and those states are Hawaii, Tennessee, Kentucky, California, West Virginia, Arkansas, Alabama, Washington, and even Alaska, though in Alaska the ratio is a lot more similar than it is in other states. It just barely includes Alaska on that list.
John, this report is stating that pot is the biggest cash crop in the U.S., so how does it compare to the other traditional agricultural crops? We have a lot of politics and policy that goes into our farming industry, so what are the other largest cash crops, and how do they compare to marijuana?
Well, first of all, the reason why marijuana is such a large cash crop is that the price for marijuana is just exorbitant compared to other crops. An acre of corn, for example, will bring a farmer maybe between $200 and $250. That's just my, you know, based on past research into this area. One single marijuana plant is more valuable than an acre of corn. And that's why we have this gargantuan value associated with marijuana. But that said, corn is about a $23.2 billion business, and I'm talking prices paid to farmers in the United States. That comes from an average of the production value of corn for 2003, 04, and 05. Now, on that basis, corn's a $23.2 billion crop, soybeans, $17.6 billion crop, hay is a $12.2 billion crop. Vegetables, all of the vegetables combined are an $11 billion crop, and wheat, which I've mentioned in kind of comparing marijuana to corn and wheat combined, wheat is a $7.5 billion crop.
John, as you point out in the report, the purpose of the Federal Controlled Substances Act is to control the production and distribution of a given substance. Have we done anything to control marijuana production in America in the last 25, 30 years?
No, we haven't. It's a totally free market. The one of the papers by academics that was published around the time the Controlled Substances Act was passed, it pointed out that you could ban and control a substance like cyclamates, which was a concern about. It's a sweetener for diet soft drinks, for example, and And they said there was concern that cyclamates cause cancer. And they said, look, we can ban cyclamates because it's hard to manufacture. You need a factory. It's easy to go find a factory and monitor it and make sure that either nothing's produced or that we can keep track of all the production. But if you can't control the manufacturer of it, this set of rules is just not going to work. And that's what's happened with marijuana. There's just no way to control the production because it has diffused. It has spread out to so many places. And that's the history of the of marijuana cultivation. And by the way, I just want to point out that I brought up cyclamates and cancer. Remember paraquat. In the late 1970s, the U.S. government was spraying the herbicide paraquat in Mexico to kill marijuana plants in the field in Mexico before it could be harvested and brought to the U.S. But what happened was some of the Mexican growers harvested their plants immediately when they'd been sprayed and brought them to market, and American marijuana consumers were very concerned that they were buying marijuana that was poisoned with this herbicide, and that poison would cause very severe damage to their lungs. And that's one of the things that started the American marijuana, the trend of growing marijuana in America.
Also, too, John, when we talk about comparing pot to other cash crops, you mentioned the exorbitant price, especially for good marijuana. But if we did drop the price through legalization, would local governments and the federal government see a significant tax revenue?
Absolutely. There's a point where you tax a commodity too much and then you create another black market. I mean, let's just assume that we get rid of the black market in marijuana by making it a legal substance. There's a point where the government brings the price up so high through taxes that it kind of creates it creates a new black market. But absent that phenomena, the fact is people who use marijuana have shown that they value it and they will pay $200-$300 an ounce. One would hope that the cost of marijuana in a legal market would drop considerably, but by the way, this $35.8 billion figure I quote, that's price to farmers, and that's only the price to farmers for domestically grown marijuana. We import anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 metric tons of marijuana from other countries. And then when you consider the cost of what someone pays at the retail end of this, we're talking about a market that is 50, 70, 90, maybe $100 billion. There's a way that can be collapsed down and still pull $5, $10 billion in tax revenue out of that. Now, I'm just giving that as a very general figure. But the fact that people are willing to pay what they pay nowadays for marijuana, they place that kind of value on it, indicates there's a lot of room for state and federal excise taxes, and there's a lot of opportunities there for states to pay for things like education and transportation that they're struggling to find funds for now. And frankly, the federal government has a much bigger burden on national security issues and even something simple. You'd think it would be simple, that they're talking right now this very week about increasing the size of the Army and the Marine Corps. And whether one, however one feels about the use of our military overseas, a larger military in many respects creates a greater deterrent and creates an environment where they don't really have to use the force. But to add 10,000 soldiers to the Army is going to cost $1.2 billion a year. That money's got to come from someplace, and so the idea of taxing marijuana creates a brand new funding source for a lot of programs at both the state and the federal level.
And John, to sum up here, how do we take this data and turn it into policy so that we can begin to see a tax benefit from marijuana in the U.S.?
Well, the first thing to realize is that the burden of proof here is not upon us to justify legalization. The burden of proof is on the government and law enforcement to justify continued funding for the same old programs and policies that have obviously failed. By the government's own admission, totally independent of my analysis and anyone else's, by their own admission, the marijuana market in this country has grown tenfold in 25 years. There's no way you call that a successful program. The name of the program is an eradication suppression program. Suppression means abolish by force. The goal of this program is to eliminate marijuana cultivation. In fact, trends have gone in the complete opposite direction. In the 1990s, and this is covered in another report that that Normal published on arrests for them a couple of years ago, marijuana arrests doubled in the 1990s with no appreciable impact on marijuana use. So the fact is the marijuana phenomena is completely uncontrolled and unregulated and is not doing anything to meet its own objectives, which is controlling marijuana use. And I think the most important objective that I think every American agrees on and actually has some support for is to eliminate or, more realistically, reduce access for teenagers to marijuana. And this report, I think, crystallizes the issue that we're not making any progress. We have no control over this market. And I'll tell you what that means when it comes to teenage marijuana use. I don't think a lot of teenagers are out there growing marijuana. I don't think they're growing the kind of marijuana that you know is causing these types of growth in the market. But teenagers are selling marijuana. And one of the stats that that was published in the Normal Arrest Report, there's a nice table in there about this. There are over a million teenagers who sell marijuana to their friends and acquaintances at school. And this is one of the things that distinguishes marijuana use in by teenagers from alcohol and tobacco. If we legalized marijuana and took some of these incredible profits out of it, not only would marijuana consumers save a lot of money, but we would also eliminate the profit incentive that there is for teenagers to sell marijuana to each other. And frankly, if we want to have better progress in our education and prevention programs to discourage teenage drug abuse, if we cut down on the availability of marijuana by simply eliminating these million teenage drug sellers per year, I think we can make a lot of progress. And that's something I think that will appeal to all adults, no matter what they think about adult marijuana use.
John Getman is the author of the new report, Marijuana Production in the United States 2006. John, thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
You can read the full report with the link we have at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.